You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Today for Dear Science, we have our lovely expert, Alan Blackman. Alan, how are you today?
I'm very well, Alex, and you're yet another Wire host that I guess I've outlasted, I suppose. So there's been quite a few of them since we started this. So yeah,
pretty big shoes to fill, to be honest.
Yeah,
yeah. What have you got for us today in the world of science?
What have we got? Well, number one, actually, this is sort of topical because there's an eclipse tonight. So there's a lunar eclipse kicking off at around about 9, sort of full darkness or whatever you want to call it, around about 11, and it comes out of the shadow about 1. So if you've got nothing else to do, and it looks like blue sky out there, I think, at the moment, have a nosy at that. But related to that, we're going to talk about the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile, which has just basically come online. And this is very, very exciting for astronomers around the world. Vera C. Rubin was an American astronomer, and she was very instrumental, if you can be very instrumental, in gathering evidence for the existence of this thing called dark matter, this stuff in the universe that makes up an awful lot of the universe and we have no idea what it is. And so she was very, very big in that, and was honoured, sadly she's passed away, but was honoured by having this wonderful new observatory named after her. So let's think about telescopes, because normally you think about a telescope, it's a big long tube, and you look down it, and that's the problem with it, is you can only see a very, very small part of the sky at any time. And that means that you could be looking at one part of the sky and you're missing something that's going on elsewhere, which you don't want to do. So the Rubin Observatory is different in this respect, because now it can image a large part of the sky. And when I say large, this might not seem very big, but it's sort of about the diameter of about 7 full moons, apparently. So they can take photos of that at unprecedented rates and at unprecedented resolutions. So that's kind of cool. So the reason they can do that is that they've got an 8.4 meter wide mirror. Okay, 8.4 meter, that's humongous, absolutely enormous. Okay, and because of the size of this mirror, they can scan the entire sky basically once every 3 to 4 nights, there or thereabouts. So you look up at the sky, it's big, it's massive, and you've got a telescope that can cover this every 3 to 4 nights, taking 3,200 megapixel images every 39 seconds. So it can take a portion of the sky, 39 seconds, bomp, go to the next bit, go to the next bit. For comparison, your very, very best top-of-the-line cameras that you can buy are around about 400 megapixels. So, you know, we're talking extraordinary resolution. And now the brilliant thing with this is what they do is that because they're doing it so quickly, they can then compare the data that they get with a reference image, those pieces of data every 39 seconds, and if they see something that's different in that reference image, they know that something happened, and so they can put out an alert. And so it's just so happened, as I said, it's just come online, and the other night it put out 800,000 alerts in one night. Okay, so these are 800,000 things that happened in the sky that are different. Okay, the sky is now different to what it was when they collected the reference images. And not only that, but when it's really up and running, they reckon by the end of the year they'll get about 7 million alerts every night of something going on. And why is that important? Well, you know, we've got things like, you know, supernovae and stuff like that, so exploding stars, all of that amazing stuff that happens way up, and again, if you're just using a normal telescope, you could easily miss that. But the, you know, the rate that they can do this, this then allows them to, you know, get in touch with the Webb telescope or the Hubble telescope. You know, if they see something going on, they can then point all the telescopes on the planet towards this particular thing if it's something really, really important, and you know, they're not going to miss it, which is very, very cool. So more numbers. So every night's observations, so that's around about 10 terabytes of data. And just for comparison, so a DVD contains about 4.7 gigabytes, and so that's equivalent to around about 200 to 400 movies, okay, of data every night. So, you know, that's quite a bit. And again, for comparison's sake, the Hubble Space Telescope, over its 30-year lifetime, collected 430 terabytes. They're getting 10 terabytes a night, okay? So that's 43 nights, and they've got more data than the Hubble Space Telescope over 30 years, which is absolutely extraordinary. All the data are free to the public. So, you know, this is an extraordinarily exciting time to be an astronomer, really.
I will say, what is it that... Because it almost feels like we've cracked something here with this telescope. Is this like the future of telescopes?
Yes, it is, until they make the next big leap. You know, this is all the application of technology. You know, this is your charge-coupled devices that are collecting the light. You know, they're getting better and better and better. Data storage... You know, it's all that, and this will continue. This will be out of date in 20 to 30 years probably. You know, and they'll have something even better. That's assuming that all the bloody Starlink satellites haven't sort of blocked our view of the cosmos. But anyway, we won't go there.
That is phenomenal. Like, I read when I was reading through the article, when I was reading those numbers, and I did have to do a double take. That's so many things.
Yes, it is. Yeah. No, it's extraordinary stuff. So, yeah. So, for our next story.
What do we got next?
Okay. Let's go to basketball/netball/ any game that you play in a gym which involves squeaky shoes. Because I'm pretty sure everyone's familiar with that very intense, very high-pitched squeak that shoes make on the gym floor. And so people have thought, there's nothing special about that. It's just friction. But some workers in the UK and the US and France decided to look at this in a little bit more detail because they weren't quite sure about that. And this has ended up in a publication in Nature just last week. And so there's much, much more to it than just being straight friction. So we normally think of friction as being sort of, it's either on or off. It's either sticking or it's slipping, or it's sticking or it's slipping. So that's sort of the explanation of how friction works. You know, things stick until the forces build up and then they slip. And then they stick. And we sort of think of things like earthquakes, for example, in this sort of way that, you know, we're building up pressure, and then slip and earthquake and et cetera, et cetera. And so this, they call this the stick slip friction. And now this works as an explanation well, provided you're talking about hard surfaces, okay, where the two surfaces involved are hard. But when we're in the gym and we're in our shoes with the rubber soles, then no, it's not the same at all, okay? So we're talking now about a soft material on a hard material, and that's what got these scientists in the UK and the US and France interested. You know, is this fundamentally different? And what they found was that, yes, it is. And so what they used was high-speed optical imaging and coupled with synchronized audio. And they're basically looking at a piece of rubber moving across a glass surface, okay, using all this sort of high-tech stuff and everything. And what they saw was very, very interesting. So instead of just sort of sticking and slipping, they could see, in fact, because the rubber is soft, it's pliable, that it could form little wrinkles, essentially. It would form these little wrinkles or wrinkle-like zones. And what happens is that they can sort of detach and then reattach and then detach and reattach across the surface as they're moving across the surface. And that sort of constant attachment and reattachment forms the vibrations that to our ears we hear as these annoying, annoying squeaks, okay? And so basically the difference is, okay, this whole stick-slip thing, it's, you know, it's a 1-2 thing. It's either sticking or slipping. But what they're saying now is that in reality, when you've got the soft and the hard, then you've got sort of localized interactions, okay? So the whole surface of your rubber, for example, is not the same. You know, some bits of it are sticking, some bits of it are slipping, and it's that causes these really, really high, squeaky sounds, okay? And even more interesting, looking at the video, what they saw was little lightning flashes, which is kind of cool. And that comes about as a result of electrical discharges from this process, this sort of these interactions, okay, these little sort of waves and wrinkles and stuff. So that's kind of cool. And so you might think, well, what's the point of all of this? Great, we know how, you know, shoes make noise in gyms now. But again, as I sort of alluded to at the start, we think of earthquakes. Now, earthquakes aren't necessarily hard on hard. Okay, you know, you've got soft parts of the Earth's crust, the mantle, etc., and it could well be that this explanation might have implications when it comes to how earthquakes work and stuff. So, you know, absolutely worth doing. So, yeah.
I mean, I think it's so awesome, really, that, you know, the noise that our shoes make gets through. How can we understand the Earth ripping itself apart? Which is a beautiful, beautiful moment of science.
No, absolutely. So, yeah, I think that's cool stuff. And again, as we often say on Dear Science, you know, watch the space, more work will come out of this, et cetera, so, yeah. And so finally, what we're going to look at is plastics, because plastics are absolutely crucial to the way that humanity operates, that the world operates. We couldn't imagine, I don't think, a future without plastics.
We love plastic.
We do. And, you know, the fact that plastics really, they're really less than 100 years old. You know, they only sort of really got into sort of full-scale production in the 1930s, way back in the day. So, it's a relatively young technology, but in that time, we've got to the point where we're absolutely, totally reliant on plastics. And what the originators of plastics probably didn't think of was, ooh, you know, the pollution aspect of things. Because these things, plastics themselves, they are made up of very, very big molecules, big chains of molecules we call polymers. And those polymers generally are fairly stable beasties, and to break them down takes quite some effort, and, you know, just most of the time just sort of sticking them in a landfill and stuff really isn't gonna get them degrading in any sort of reasonable length of time. So a bunch of workers at Flinders University over in Oz and in a university in Colombia, the country, not the university in New York. And so they have just published a paper where they describe a new plastic that is very biodegradable and has got promises being a single-use plastic. So the main problem with plastics is the single-use plastics, okay? And that makes up around about 60-odd percent, apparently, of plastic usage. You know, like food packaging, for instance, you know, that's a very, very big thing with single-use plastics. So if we could get a decent biodegradable single-use food packaging capable plastic, the world would be a much better place. And so they have made one of these, they've certainly sort of demonstrated anyway, that it biodegrades in around about 13 weeks in soil, which is a big plus. And the reason that it does that, or probably part of the reason anyway, is because it's made from molecules that occur in nature. So it's made predominantly from casein, which comes from milk, and starch, which, you know, is everywhere, and a clay called bentonite. And you might think, God, putting a clay in a plastic, that's going to make it weird, but this seems to work. They throw in a little bit of glycerol, a little bit of polyvinyl alcohol, just to make it pliable and soft and everything, and this seems to work nicely. So it seems that it's sort of resistant to bugs and stuff like that, so that's all good. So that makes it eminently suitable to use in food packaging, and it could reduce pollution substantially, okay? Now, again, this is just a preliminary result. There is a lot of work that is being done and has been done on biodegradable plastics, because people realize just how important the plastic problem is. We talk about microplastics. We talked about that on the show a few weeks ago, the problems and the questions of microplastics. So it's really, really good to see that somebody's taking this seriously, that they're doing work on this. And hopefully, in the future, this might all come to fruition and create a better planet, I guess, a less polluted one. So we will see. Again, watch this space.
Awesome. Well, I'm not a fan of milk itself, so hey, maybe if
neither am I. Actually.
Maybe if we can get some environmental benefit from plastic, it's a better usage than avoiding it in the supermarket.
Well,
aisle,
that's a very good point. The milk manufacturers would be thrilled about this if there's a use for casein. So yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. Thanks, Alan. And thank you, MOTAT, and thank you, Science. STEM Fair is back again at MOTAT. Enjoy hands-on activities and demonstrations all week long from the 28th and the 29th of March.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.